From the KGOU studios, I'm Suzette Gorlot, the Dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies, and welcome to Worldviews. Lionel Vigil works for the Oklahoma City-based NGO World Neighbors in Latin America and the Caribbean. They focus on family farming, credit and savings, sanitation, and clean water.
And the household have clean water in their homes, so they don't have to use any chlorine. They don't have to boil water because it's expensive.
I'll talk with Vigil on today's show. But first, Jacob McClellan joins me from Panama, where he will provide an update about the country's troubles with corruption and a growing concern about rising cases of HIV/AIDS among indigenous populations.
Even though it's been nearly 40 years that the world has known about HIV/AIDS, in some parts of the world, you're still seeing just the basic knowledge about the disease taking hold.
That's all coming up after news from NPR. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gorlot. We're actually going to turn the microphone around on Jacob McClellan, our usual producer, who is in Panama. And I think we can hear some traffic there from where he's where he is right now. But he's there doing some reporting for NPR. And so we wanted to bring him into our conversation today to tell us a little bit about this country that he spent a lot of time in. He was a Peace Corps volunteer there, and he's there doing some reporting on health crises, but also some of their political, economic, social concerns regarding corruption. So, Jacob, welcome to this side of the microphone and on Worldviews. Tell us what you're doing there in Panama.
Well, fantastic, Suzette. It's great talking with you today. And the reason you hear the traffic is I'm actually standing in the former canal zone at the moment, and I could actually see the Panama Canal from where I'm standing. And the reporting that I'm working on while I'm here is on HIV/AIDS outbreaks that have been taking place among indigenous populations in Panama. There's been an outbreak, nearly about half of new infections, maybe a little bit more in the last couple of years, have come from one indigenous group in western Panama that lives in a very remote area. It's very rustic. It's a place that's difficult to access. And even though, as we've seen, HIV and AIDS become more of a chronic disease in recent years in a lot of areas, in places like this where there's difficulty in accessing the proper treatment or even diagnosis, it can often become fatal. People often aren't diagnosed until the disease is well established and it becomes difficult to provide them treatment. And on top of that, we're really looking at here in these indigenous communities a lot of lack of understanding. There's a lot of myths about how HIV/AIDS is contracted. A lot of people believe that you can get it from sharing utensils or from a handshake or from mosquitoes, which is a common belief here. It's been nearly 40 years that the world has known about HIV/AIDS. In some parts of the world, you're still seeing just the basic knowledge about the disease taking hold.
Well, that is very interesting. You're looking at this, and this comes along this health crisis and others with other crises in Panama. They've got corruption scandals, all kinds of political issues going on, and some civil society response, perhaps, regarding that, some pushback. There's a significant amount of inequality there. And so can you give us the lay of the land along those lines and how that has had an impact on kind of these social and health issues?
Yeah, absolutely. And when you start talking about those inequality issues, I've been coming to Panama pretty regularly for the last 15 years. And you just see all of this dramatic change in Panama City with this glistening skyline, a subway system, and all of this development here centered in Panama City. But once you leave Panama City and head out into the interior, it's still a very traditional, rustic lifestyle, in particular when you end up going to some of the indigenous communities where there's very little access to roads, electricity, or even in some places, clean water. And as far as corruption here, yeah, that has been one of the big things. And a lot of it ties to Odebrecht, the Brazilian construction firm that's been fingered for a lot of different corruption scandals throughout Latin America. In fact, two of former President Ricardo Martinelli's sons apparently accepted up to $49 million in bribes from Odebrecht. And the current president, Juan Carlos Varela, has apparently admitted to accepting campaign contributions from Odebrecht as well as some bribes. In fact, he told this to his friend, who is one of the partners in the law firm that was at the center of the Panama Papers investigation. And also we have the former president, Martinelli, who I mentioned earlier. He is currently being hounded by corruption allegations as well. He's been in the United States for a while and was recently detained by U.S. authorities and is still being detained since June, awaiting extradition charges to Panama.
Well, what I've been able to gather is that there's a real problem with, would you call it organized crime, Jacob? I mean, this seems to be that the kind of public relations are kind of very much a family business, and this kind of corruption and bribery is pretty typical and widespread in the last few seconds we have.
Yeah, sure. Power in Panama is often concentrated in the hands of a few wealthy families. There have been a couple of families that, in particular that I can think of. The Torrijos family has had two different presidents over the last few decades, as well as Mireya Moscoso was the president of the late 90s, early 2000s. She was the wife of the former president as well. So there's definitely politics and power definitely seems to be a family affair here.
All right, Jacob. Well, thanks for calling in from Panama. Good luck with the rest of your work and your reporting there. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you so much, Suzette.
We'd love to hear your thoughts about this discussion or answer any questions you might have. Leave your comments in the Worldview section of KGOU.org or like us, follow us, and interact with us on Twitter. We're at Worldviews KGOU, and I'm at Suzette Grelot. Next, I'll talk with Lionel Vigil about World Neighbors development work in Latin America and the Caribbean. I'm Suzette Grelot, and this is Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Grelot, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Lionel Vigil is the Regional Director for Latin America and the Caribbean for the Oklahoma City-based NGO World Neighbors. The organization works throughout the world on many types of projects, including sustainable agriculture and water and sanitation. Lionel Vigil, welcome to Worldviews.
Thank you.
For World Neighbors, you serve as the regional director for Latin America and the Caribbean. And so I want to get to some of the work that you're doing in Latin America. But could you tell us a little bit first, Lionel, about your background? And in particular, as I was doing my research on you and I read your bio, that your education, your formal education, at least initially, was in midwifery.
That's correct.
So can you tell us a little bit about that, where you come from, what you studied, and how midwifery led you down this path to studying development or working in development?
Yeah, I was graduated from the University of San Martin, which is located in the northeast part of Peru, far away from Lima. It's in the jungle area of Peru, actually. There was, at that time, in the 1980s, at the beginning of the 1980s, it was the new open national university with only four faculties, engineering, midwifery, agronomy, and another faculty. So I wanted to study medicine. So the closest relationship with medicine was midwifery. So that's I decided to study that, thinking that in the future I may upgrade to medicine. However, after I finished my education, which took many years, like 6 or 7 years after doing the practicing in hospitals, I just came to Lima from San Martin, finding for new jobs. And then there was this opportunity to move and to looking for postgraduate education in the UK. So I just went to the UK for 2 years. Looking for, a postgraduate in biomedical science, things like that. So eventually I couldn't get any scholarship there, so that's why I decided to come back to Peru, and then I found a job in education. So that's why I also have a degree in education with a major in natural science. And then I just became involved in working for the Minister of Education, and then starting working for the in local NGO in reproductive health and education. And then from local NGO, I had the opportunity to work for other international development organizations like the Management Science for Health, for instance, which is based in the United States as well. And then I just worked also for other organizations because this organization have projects that last for 3 to 5 years. And then when your project finishes, you move along into another organization. So I work for another UK-based organization called Every Child, which has to do with dealing with child abuse prevention and also funded by the USAID projects. I was a program coordinator and then monitoring and supervising other people. And then I find another opportunity also working with Norwegian organizations called Strong Foundations, which I was in charge of the education area, the bilingual education, which means helping children to develop a curriculum in which they use Quechua as their mother tongue and Spanish, and helping them to upgrade their knowledge and the learning process that they have. And I was in charge of supervising Bolivia and also Peru programs and small NGO that were receiving funding from the Norwegian organization called Strong Foundations. And after that, I just had this opportunity to work with World Neighbors, which has been working for 5 years so far.
So tell us a little bit about some of the projects that you've been working on. It sounds like education largely. Are there other types of development projects that you've been doing in Bolivia, Guatemala, Peru? Those seem to be your Latin American countries that you primarily focus on.
Yeah, actually our main focus on as World Neighbors is strengthening the capacities of people, helping them through workshops and to gain the skills in family farming, you know, to diversify their farms, the use of the local resource they have, and to go into organic farming, to produce composting, to use all the leftovers of the agriculture products to be reused and come back into the soil again so they can actually use that in a more efficient way rather than buying inorganic fertilizers or on other chemical things that actually don't have the money to do that, and it's very expensive to do that. But so we teach them, we help them to go into family farming. Also, we have this big, large component in World Neighbors working in those countries, which is water sanitation and hygiene. You know, water is one of the key issues, and that's why I am in this water conference as well, in which people have they drink dirty water and that produce gastrointestinal diseases, and we help people to use the Biosan water filter, which was a kind of innovation for our programs in all those four countries, in which the block of concrete is made with a mold of iron cast mold, in which you put layers of gravel and sand, and then any kind of water coming from rainwater or water from the river is filtered through this process. So this is two aspects of this filtration process. One is physical process, and the other is the biolayer, which is on the top of the water. And the household have clean water in their homes, so they don't have to use any kind of chlorine. They don't have to boil water because it's expensive. They don't have to. I mean, it's actually a very adaptive the technique or equipment that they have that they can last for 20, 30 years in their homes. And the other is sanitation. We are promoting all these dry pit latrines, I mean improved latrines. So they use sawdust and these latrines become less dirty and the smell disappears from the homes and the house flies have not been around. So that creates the improving life of the people. So this is farming agriculture, water sanitation and hygiene, and another core component in Latin America is the savings and credit groups. I mean, it is something very innovative as well, because the differentiation between microfinance is that these saving and credit groups helps actually the people who stay there, because they are the ones who organize. We train them with the, what we call financial education. They decide how much the interest rate that they will have to pay every beneficiary from the group. So the differentiation from microfinance is most of this microfinance, I'm not against it, but I just want to stress the difference. These microfinance programs in other organizations, in other projects, is that benefits the organization itself. But in the case of the World Neighbors, these savings and credit groups, it's actually benefited the people. So it stayed with them. So we contribute once with seed capital, which could be $100, and they can grow and everybody can benefit and they can start and last for many years. It's very sustainable. So that's why we stress that component as well.
You're listening to my conversation with Lionel Vigil. He's the regional director for Latin America and the Caribbean for World Neighbors. After the break, we'll discuss some of World Neighbors' agriculture projects, including guinea pig farming in the Andes. I'm Suzette Guerlat, and this is Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Guerlat. Our guest today is Lionel Vigil. He works for the Oklahoma City-based NGO World Neighbors as the director for the development programs in Latin America and the Caribbean. I want to go back to agriculture for a second, though. Can you just tell us what their agricultural products are largely, and is this largely for their own subsistence, or are they doing export-based agricultural activity, or are they just looking at local communities largely?
Well, actually, we work with family farmers, actually. So family farmers have not very large land, but they optimize the use of the land by crop diversifications and efficient use of water and improving the new techniques in how to not only rely on cash crops like coffee, for instance, or avocado things, but also they use the seasonal green vegetables they can grow. And they grow it for self-consumptions, but the surplus they can sell. But it also, in terms of family farming, we don't only think about growing crops, but also livestock.
I was going to ask about the livestock issue, because I read that you've been involved in a project regarding guinea pigs in Peru, that guinea pigs are a very popular meal, and that guinea pig farming is really picked up, and that it grows very quickly and can actually support a family very quickly. So can you tell us a little bit about that type of project?
Yeah, that's right. So we have been promoting that kind of guinea pigs farms. Not because we wanted them to do that, because the farmers asked, why World Neighbors don't help us to have these guinea pig farms? Actually, guinea pig farm has been a traditional culture in the Andes. And because most of there was a lot of migration from the Andes coming to the capital. So it became, over the time, a popular meal in Peru. Now I will say that 70% of people would have tasted guinea pigs in different ways, like the fried guinea pigs or boneless flesh guinea pigs. And that demand has made these farmers to encourage to have these guinea pig farms. Guinea pigs were raised traditionally in their home for self-consumption. But now, since there is a demand in the capital and there is a demand in the middle-sized cities, so these guinea pigs, it becomes a profitable business. But I wouldn't say that guinea pig farming will make a farmer get out of poverty. But it will be part of this farming component, very important farming component for income generation or self-consumption. And because also these guinea pigs, it's strange for everybody, for people who are not from Peru or from, because guinea pigs are considered as pets. But you know, the quality of the meat of the guinea pigs is very, very healthy, and no cholesterol, and the protein is 45% of quality protein. I mean, it's something that it is awkward for many people. It's strange to eat these pets, but in the Andes, these guinea pigs are not seen like that, you know.
Yeah, it's definitely a different cultural thing, just like perhaps in other countries as well. Finally, I just have to ask you about your work in the Caribbean, because you're the regional director for Latin America and the Caribbean, and you've done some work in Haiti and elsewhere. What are some of the development comparisons between the two as we kind of conclude this conversation in terms of what kind of work and projects you do in countries like Bolivia and Peru compared to Haiti? Are you working on similar projects? Do they face some of the same problems?
Yeah, we work in similar projects, and we work in the same components in farming, agriculture, and livestock, and savings and credits. But the challenges that we have are different, of course. For instance, we have been working for many years. Board Neighbor has been working since its foundation or inception 65 years ago in Haiti. And we have made a lot of progress in strengthening organizations. I think there is a lot of social capital in the rural areas in Haiti where we have been working. There are large community-based organizations who have been able to grow food and to get also connection with other organizations that supports them. So if you go to these isolated, vulnerable villages in Haiti, far away from Port-au-Prince, you will find that they are actually making a living all these components that I'm talking about. And from my perspective, from my experience, the most developed community-based organizations are in Haiti now. But because a lot of inputs have been, a lot of resources, a lot of thinking, a lot of projects have been put in Haiti. So now those communities in the rural areas in Haiti are more resilient to any kind of problems that Port-au-Prince or the country can face. You know, everybody knows, we know that Haiti is a country that has been, the government is weak and the institutions are not in place, but in the rural areas, people find a living and a good place to live.
Well, that's very interesting, Lionel, I think we could continue a conversation just about Haiti, but it's interesting to hear that perhaps in the rural areas in particular, there's some interesting development going on there. So thank you for sharing that with us. Thank you for being here today. Appreciate you telling us about your work.
Thank you to you.
You've been listening to my conversation with Lionel Vigil. He's the regional director for Latin America and the Caribbean for World Neighbors, an NGO based in Oklahoma City. Worldviews is produced in partnership between KGOU and the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Katie Holland prepares our research, Jacob McClellan edited this interview, and Sam Dupre produced the show. For Jacob McClellan, I'm Suzette Gorlott.